Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest in the OIES podcast series. My name is James Henderson. I'm Director of the Energy Transition Research Initiative at OIES. Today, I'm joined by Robin Baker, who is a visiting fellow at the Institute, and Philippe Benoit, who is Research Director for Global Infrastructure Analytics and Sustainability 2050, and is also a visiting fellow at OIES. And we're going to be discussing the theme of their latest paper, which is going to get published in the summer of 2022, which is entitled How Project Finance Can Advance the Clean Energy Transition in Developing Countries. And just before I introduce them, I should date this podcast as well in this ever-changing world. We are recording on the 8th of June, 2022. So with that, Robin, Philippe, welcome to the podcast series.
Thank you very much, James. Pleasure to be here.
Glad to be here as well.
Great. Well, look, let's get stuck in because this is a very, very important topic, but probably the most important topic for the energy transition because there's a huge amount of investment needed to meet climate change targets globally and in particular in developing countries. Philippe, perhaps you can start and tell me, is the finance actually available out there?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that question. And as you noted, I think in some ways it reflects the biggest challenge. If I could just take a step back and put this in context, we see two important trends taking place. The first is growing economies across the developing world, which are translating into the need for ever-increasing amounts of energy. In particular, we've seen a shift in terms of the requirement for energy demand from developed countries to developing countries, which now dominate the energy landscape and will increasingly do so going forward. In addition, the clean energy transition in and of itself requires substantial amounts of investments in a new type of energy or a new emerging type of energy, namely clean energy. So, for example, the IEA in a recent report estimated that while existing clean energy investments across the developing world, and for these purposes will exclude China, totaled about $150 billion in 2020. In order to meet our climate goals, that amount would have to increase to $600 billion annually by 2030 in order to achieve the well below 2 degree target encapsulated in the Paris Agreement, and to over $1 trillion to meet the more aggressive 1.5. And so we see a massive amount of additional financing that is required in order to get these investments to take place. The interesting thing is when you look at how much money is actually being invested annually in the energy transition, we see at about $1.8 trillion for all global energy investments. So in some ways, to a large extent, the money is there at a global level. It's just not headed in the right direction, either in terms of clean investments and specifically in terms of clean investments in the developing world.
So I'm glad you made that point about it just not going in the right directions, because obviously that's one of the main themes we saw at COP26. And I know we're going to see it at COP27, which is in the developing world, in Africa. What are your thoughts about, you know, what policymakers are doing and what countries are actually implementing around the, for example, $100 billion that was promised from the developed to the developing world?
Well, unfortunately, what we've seen time and time again is that the developed world has yet to meet that original pledge of $100 billion annually for support to developing countries. In that regard, I think it's important when we're talking about developing countries to be very clear that we're not simply talking about Africa. We're talking, first and foremost, in many ways, about Asia, Southeast Asia, India, and other countries where the expected increase in energy demand is projected to be the largest. And what's very notable about all those countries is that they have a dual challenge, the challenge of decarbonization, but also the challenge of development. These countries are poorer countries with a real need to continue to raise standards of living, to achieve the type of standards of living that we enjoy in the United States or in the UK. And meeting this dual challenge of continuing to support economic growth, raising standards of living while decarbonizing, means that you need to shift your investment patterns to these clean energy investments. And that is actually designed to serve everybody's interests, both rich and poor. And that's why, in this regard, there's been a lot of pressure within the COP context, as well as in the international dialogue generally, to have richer countries do more to support the ability of poorer countries, even of Vietnam and other countries like that, to be able to develop in a green way.
Okay, thanks for that. Robin, let me come to you now then, and let's get into the paper more specifically. The paper is focused on debt rather than equity. Why have you decided to do that?
That's a good question. Both are important, of course, but debt is particularly important because if you look at the renewable business industry, it's primarily highly capital intensive. If you look at renewable power, wind or solar particularly, the costs are all capital costs, not the operating costs are very low. Now, the implications of that are that finance is the biggest cost factor feeding through into the energy price. And as we know, energy prices are highly sensitive in most countries, but perhaps particularly in some of the more emerging markets. So debt is important for cost reasons. One should not focus only on amounts of finance, but the cost of finance. And for that, we need debt.
Because essentially, you know, for beginners, debt is less expensive than equity.
Exactly.
So what determines then the level of debt and what are the implications for the industry structure?
Well, there is a long track record of financing thermal power projects in many, but mostly the stronger countries, whereby the capital equipment, the generation plant, is set up as utility. It's ring-fenced from the trading of power, and it's financed on a basis where there are contractual or regulatory arrangements providing a long-term predictable revenue flow to that stream. This has been very popular in Europe, in the United States, and in the Gulf countries of the Middle East. The model allows the power generation to be bid out to people who will provide the capital and the finance that comes with it. They've typically raised about 80% debt, and that's achieved a relatively low cost of developing that power. Now, that model is now being applied to renewable energy quite extensively, again, in typically in OECD countries. The challenge is to stretch that now to some of the more difficult countries.
Okay, so, Philip, let me come back to you then. That challenge to get this structure out to the developing world, but also where's the money actually going to come from?
So the money needs to come from a variety of key sources, many of which are actually traditional sources. Commercial banks, picking up on Robin's point, will need to play a critical role in financing the clean energy transition in developing countries. And that means both commercial banks in the domestic markets of these countries, but also commercial banks internationally. As a general proposition, when we look at some of the projections regarding where and what type of financing would be needed for the clean energy transition, we see two notable factors. The first is a significant amount of debt, as Robin described. Some of the estimates point to about 50% of the financing needs to be in the form of debt. And then the other is about 30% international and 70% domestic. Both those numbers are striking and important. The first, while 30% may seem small, when you think about that $600 billion figure I mentioned just for the well below two target, we're talking about $180 billion worth of international financing. And when it comes to domestic sources, what this sort of highlights is that there's going to be a need to look beyond simply the capacity of commercial banks to be able to tap into other sources of savings within domestic economies, pension funds, and other potential sources of funding.
Okay, well, look, let's talk about a bit more about banks, because obviously they've got huge experience and have raised a lot of finance for power generation, oil and gas. Why can't this just be redirected to clean energy, particularly as banks are taking against sort of the hydrocarbon industry?
I think that raises a very important point that I would sort of say to some extent is somewhat overlooked when we're talking about the clean energy transition. As I mentioned at the very beginning, there is a lot of money that is going to finance energy projects in developing countries. We just think about all the oil and gas projects. The thing about clean energy projects is that they tend to be local currency generating infrastructure projects. And that has two important implications. The first is they tend to be relatively flat, modest return projects. That's what you would expect in the power side, as well as transport and the like. And the other point is that they generate local currencies. And as a result, that presents a completely different type of risk profile for and notably international financiers than export oil and gas projects. It's not a question of pumping oil out of the ground, putting it on a ship and selling it to the United States in dollars or to Europe in euros. You're talking about clean energy projects, for example, renewable projects that will generate kilowatt hours that will be sold into the Indonesian domestic market for rupiahs, into South Africa for rands, and other emerging economies. And as a result, the type of risk profile you're looking at, the type of financing that you're looking at is very much akin, as Robin was describing, to the long-term infrastructure financing that we've been able to see succeed in advanced economies, and very different from the oil and gas high return export projects that have been able to attract so much capital to date.
I wonder if you could just, for our listeners, you could give a quick example of the different risk profiles, or, you know, an example when a domestic projects versus export projects, that we can actually see that difference model, if you like.
Okay, so for example, if we take an LNG project like they're thinking of doing out of Mozambique, Mozambique would be viewed by most investors as a high risk environment. You probably would not have many investors, commercial investors, other than development organizations like the World Bank that are mandated to do this specifically, that would be willing to lend money to build a power plant in Mozambique that would sell power into the Mozambican domestic market. A couple of risks that they would face. One is the possibility and prospect that the local currency will devalue relative to the dollar loan. The other one are domestic political uncertainties. Third one is, will the public utility that Robin referred to actually remain creditworthy over the life of the loan, be in a sufficiently robust financial position to repay that loan? These are the type of risks that would be presented by a domestic power project in Mozambique, and is exactly why you tend to see very, very little financing for those type of projects by the international private sector. In contrast, gas discoveries off the shore of Mozambique. You bring in a developer who basically pumps that gas to a specialized ring-fenced regasification plant on the coast of Mozambique. That LNG is then shipped to Europe and paid for, let's say, by a French purchaser or other European purchaser. What does that risk profile look like? First of all, the purchaser in Europe would probably be a very robust, financially robust, creditworthy off-taker, in contrast to the purchaser of electricity in Mozambique. You're also talking about payments that would be made in euros, so there's no devaluation risk. And in addition, the ability to largely isolate much of the physical attributes, physical infrastructure, would also address a variety of risks, for example, the ability to minimize possibility of government interference. So those two projects would present very different profiles. Let me just add, having said that, that the fact of the matter is an LNG project in Mozambique still will present risks, as we have seen, for example, because of the civil unrest that Mozambique recently suffered through.
Okay, thanks so much. That's really useful to have that example, just to give a little clarity around what we're talking about. Now, Robin, I'm going to come back to you, if I may. The title of your paper is How Project Finance Can Advance the Clean Energy Transition, and we haven't really talked about project finance yet, so time to get to that. Why specifically have you focused on project finance, and why is project finance helpful in this regard?
Well, let's start with what project finance does. As you know, project finance ring fences certain assets, and it provides a legal structure around those assets to avoid confusion of cash flows from other parts of a business. That in itself substantially mitigates or reduces the risk of the project, because you're not worrying about liabilities that have nothing to do with the project you're financing. So by that means, project finance can then take that structure and use it to segregate various risks. So I think there's two aspects of project finance that is helping to reduce the risk. The first one is the legal and control structure, which captures the cash flow from the project, stops anybody else getting them, and stops any other liabilities coming in to the project. So that's the first level of protection. The second thing it does, perhaps a bit less obvious, but there is extensive analysis, cash flow analysis done in project finance, which looks at all the risks you can think of, and then looks at what they do to the cash flow. And the third step in that process, having analyzed those risks, is to say, well, who's best to do something about it? And there's then an apportionment between the various counterparties. There's government, there's the developer, there's the buyers of the power. And you look at what risk can be put to each of the various people, including the project and indeed including the providers of equity and debt, in such a way that you hope each of these risks will not hurt people who are not able to accommodate those risks. So we've got a couple of different ways in which project finance can substantially reduce the risk for its projects. Now, the big benefit of that is it enables you to finance projects which you might not otherwise be able to finance. Philip mentioned Mozambique LNG, which would have been challenging from commercial banks. The many other LNG projects in Papua New Guinea, Nigeria, and elsewhere, where project finance was raised, corporate finance was not available. It's worth, just as a final point, a point that's perhaps often forgotten, commercial banks don't lend long-term other than on a structured basis like project finance. If a company wants bank finance, it probably is limited to 5 years, maybe 8 years at the most. The long-term markets are the bond markets and project finance.
Okay, thanks, Robin. Philip, let me come back to you then and perhaps talk in a little bit more detail about how project finance actually achieves the kind of goals that Robin set out. Could you give us a little bit more detail on how it actually works?
Right, so I think the key issue that Robin touched upon is that project finance allows you to segregate certain productive assets from the rest of the assets, liabilities, and operations of a potential borrower, a project sponsor. And this is particularly important when we think about the developing country context, where many of the potential sponsors of clean energy projects really just don't have the type of robust balance sheet, operational history that you would tend to see in advanced economies in the US and in Europe. So what the project finance structure allows you to do, and I'll pick, let's say, for example, a new solar project, it allows you to take that potential prospective solar project, those assets, and put them in a special purpose vehicle created for the purpose of operating this new power plant, and then allows you to separate those assets, both in terms of their operations, where you can bring in a specialized a power plant operator, as well as importantly, in terms of their financial obligations, so that they're separated from the financial obligations and liabilities of the potential owner. For example, a public utility in Indonesia or a public utility in Vietnam. That allows potential lenders to the project to focus in first and foremost on what are those assets and what are the ability of those assets to generate revenues. Those revenues under a project finance structure are typically then placed in an escrow account, and the lenders receive priority access to those revenues. And what this means is that if the plant is able to operate and if it is able to sell successfully to a purchaser, it will generate revenues and the lenders have comfort that they will get repaid. As a result, and again, stressing in particular in developing countries where many companies face a variety of financial stresses, this allows you to move away from the overall corporate balance sheet and just focus in on, are these productive assets that can, under certain credit enhancement and other control systems, generate the kilowatt hours, generate the revenues so that I can get paid? And what you will find, and this has been the experience in the United States and other countries, is that it enables you to basically allow a potential sponsor to do more projects. If I could just add one other point that I think is critical when we think about the climate area in particular. There's a lot of discussion about climate finance, about a green investment, and they are looking for green assets. And one of the big advantages of the project finance approach is it allows you to take green assets and separate them and segregate them from the other assets of a potential power company. So, for example, many power companies have coal or natural gas. What the project finance structure allows you to do is to propose a new green investment, let's say in solar, where the assets are put in a special purpose vehicle, and that should enable you to attract a lot of the green finance, climate finance, that is getting a lot of attention these days.
Great, thank you. Robin, let me come to you then. I mean, any other advantages that you want to chip in on as far as project finance is concerned?
Yes, Philip's taken the important ones, I think, to start with, but actually there are two other which are also particularly important. Firstly, in leveraging local finance, we discussed the question of currency risk. And obviously, the more you can finance in the local currency, the more you've got a matching of revenues and finance. Project finance can help bring in local banks. Sometimes they have a slightly shorter tenor than the international banks that incorporated in the same credit structure. There should be more debt that could be attracted in a lot of countries because there are domestic savings, pension funds, and other sources looking for safe long-term investments. So the challenge is to capture these, and I think project finance can help to some extent to do that. Finally, and very importantly, in leveraging support from the World Bank Group and other agencies who are already active in supporting the clean sector developments. But can we leverage their activities more? And we think we can substantially if, for example, a development agency takes a disproportionate share of some of the risks, such as currency risk. That could enable commercial banks to extend the project finance model to some of these countries, which they might not otherwise be able to do.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because, Philip, I want to come back to you as I guess, someone who's worked at the World Bank, so you can probably answer this question better than anyone. How important is that agency finance? I guess we're talking about the World Bank, we're talking about export credit agencies, other international lending agencies. What role have they got to play here?
They have a critical role. And let me just stress, and I'll come back to this, and they fundamentally and ideally have a critical role in the transition. So what we see, obviously, when we look at too many developing countries today, and as we've been discussing, they just don't present the risk profile that is sufficiently robust to attract the private sector, and in particular, the international private sector. There is a need for some type of credit enhancement. And that is why organizations like the World Bank, regional development banks, have been created, as well as you mentioned, export credit agencies, development finance institutions. There are a whole slew of organizations that have been created to support development and investments in particular developing countries. They have a critical role to play on the credit enhancement side as potential funders, as well as providing technical assistance to enable countries to actually develop the projects in the first instance. Interestingly enough, what we're seeing now is a lot of discussion about climate finance, which very much goes hand in hand with development finance. So a lot more discussion of things like the Green Climate Fund and the like. All of these public international organizations have an important role to play in funding the clean energy transition, as well as crowding in our private sector investment. But the point I made about transition is also critical, which is that if we project out 10, 15, 20 years, what we want to see and what is the mandate of the World Bank and other similar development organizations is to help countries grow their economies, improve their creditworthiness, to enable them to get to the point where basically they graduate from the need for World Bank and other specialized agency support. Countries like Vietnam and others have seen a major amount of growth, a significant ability to tap into financial markets themselves, countries like India and the like. And so fundamentally, these type of World Bank and other agencies play a critical role both in the short and medium term to actually providing the funding, but also in the longer term, helping to create the conditions under which ideally the private sector, both international and domestic, will by itself come in and fund these things. You go back to the numbers I mentioned at the beginning, $600 billion a year or over a trillion. We basically need all of these type of dynamics to be in place to achieve the results we all aspire to.
Important to make that point, indeed. There's a lot of money needs to be raised. But I guess just briefly, I mean, there has been some criticism of the World Bank for not going far enough. I mean, most recently from the US Treasury and at the latest climate conference in Bonn, you know, a few people have stood up and said the World Bank could do more. What do you think about that? Is it going far enough?
I think it's a totally fair criticism that the World Bank has not done enough, in particular in the area of financing the clean energy transition. There is a need for them to do more. They can do more. I think on a certain level, it's ironic that one of the major complaints has come from the U.S. Treasury, because part of the issue is that the World Bank is, to a certain extent, not dominated, but its major shareholder is always is the United States. Its president is always appointed by the United States government. And if you just look at U.S. policy over the last 8 years, you've seen a significant shift when it comes to climate from the Obama administration to the Trump administration and now to the Biden administration. So I think a little more consistency on the part of the World Bank's key shareholders in terms of their policy would probably have enabled the World Bank to do more. But having said that, there tends at times for the World Bank to face two type of constraints. One is it tends sometimes to be risk averse. It needs to become more aggressive when it comes to climate finance. The other thing is it tends to get too caught up in its own procedures that really slow its ability to deploy its financing quickly. So the World Bank needs to be more ambitious and more aggressive in being innovative, both in terms of the type of instruments and its willingness to deploy those instruments, as well as its willingness to get projects done quickly.
Okay, thanks for that. That's really interesting. Let's come back to the private sector then, as we get to come towards the end of this podcast. What opportunities do you see for the energy industry in helping to arrange this transition finance? I mean, is there's a big opportunity out there, you think?
No, I think there's definitely a big opportunity for the private sector to do more. And in some ways, it's a compliment to the point I made about the World Bank. What is true for the World Bank is also true for the private sector. What we have seen is a recognition by the private sector that climate change is bad for business. Climate change will be bad for business 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now. And we see from the numbers that are required, that means we need a massive amount of incremental investment. The public sector is not in a position to provide the type of numbers that I described. The private sector needs to do more for its own good, for its own benefit. It needs to, in some ways, manage the potential negative externalities created by climate change by promoting more investment in clean energy. But what our paper, interestingly enough, shows is that by using the project finance structure, the private sector can also generate more opportunities for business. That's more opportunities for energy developers, more opportunities for commercial lenders, more opportunities, basically, to make money on the way to a green future.
Great. Robin, I'm going to come to you for the last question, if I may. You mentioned bonds earlier in the podcast. We haven't really talked about bonds very much. Can you give us just some quick thoughts on bond markets as a source of green financing as well?
Yes, as I mentioned, the bond markets are the biggest source of long-term debt globally. And they're the major route through which savings from pension funds and others are directed. Interestingly, the bond markets love utilities because they provide a long-term secure income source. It's an ideal investment for them. They're also active in emerging markets where separate groups, the tenant they charge higher pricing, will be active in emerging markets. But they tend not to do both at the same time, and that needs to change. The risk factor has got to be controlled. One has got to get the risk down to a sort of investment-grade risk, which is acceptable to investors. And that's where we think we need the various agencies to help de-risk these projects. But if you can do that, we also need to get the bond markets to pay attention to this sector and look for opportunities where there will be opportunities for long-term attractive investments. It's happening to a very small extent at the moment. There is interest. The green bond market will facilitate it because there's an interest in green bonds, but a lot more needs to be done.
Okay, well, look, Philip, Robin, thank you very much indeed for your contributions. Just to highlight again that your paper, How Project Finance Can Advance the Clean Energy Transition in Developing Countries, will be out in the next couple of months. And also, you're both joining us for a discussion on green finance at our energy transition workshops in the latter half of June. So look forward to that as well. But in the meantime, again, thanks for your contributions. Thanks to everyone for listening. Please go to our website and look out for this report during the summer and all our other research on the energy transition. But with that, thank you very much again for listening. Stay healthy and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org. Thank you.